Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. I'd like to say that I discovered a rare, unknown recording of John Perkins speaking in West Hartford, Connecticut in January 2005. Of course, saying I discovered it would be pretty dumb, like saying that Balboa discovered the Pacific Ocean in 1513. Well, the Pacific may have been news to Balboa, but at the time there must have been, let's say, 1 million people who were already pretty well acquainted with it. Okay, when I discovered the recording, there was maybe one person who was already pretty well acquainted with it. This was friend, colleague, general good guy, and ace audio engineer John Schwenk. In fact, John had made the recording and, a few weeks back, kindly offered to send a copy my way. Okay, I'm willing to share discovery credit with John, if he insists. Seriously, though, this is a fine talk, given soon after Perkins published his famous Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Perkins tells of how the empire was built, beginning in the years just after World War II. Decades later, Perkins was one of the builders, employed by a national security agency front group, making the world profitable for the transnational corporate oligarchy. For it's not really an American empire. It's an empire serving transnational corporate power. In this first of two parts, Perkins tells how the empire was created and grew, and how it functions. Part of his narrative is public history. Part is his own personal story. He tells of the CIA's overthrow of the democratic government in Iran in 1953. He tells how he himself was recruited in 1968. He tells of two of his early professional failures, his inability to corrupt the leaders of Panama, Omar Torrijos, and of Ecuador, Jaime Roldós. After Perkins and others failed, both men died in mysterious aircraft explosions. Next week, we'll hear Perkins talk about one of his major successes, Saudi Arabia. Okay, corrupting the House of Saud was less of a challenge than corrupting Panama's Torrijos. Still, the stakes were enormous. Speaking in West Hartford on January 10, 2005, here's John Perkins.
We're going to be looking at post-World War II history of the world. And from my perspective, that's largely the story of building a new empire, the first empire that's been truly global in the history of the world, and also the first empire that's been built primarily without the military, primarily through economics, through economic hitmen like me. And we're going to be looking at where that's brought us today in this world. And then I'd like to talk about September 11th and the amazing impact that that had on me, why I wrote this book, and what I think the connection between September 11th and this empire is. And then looking at where we go from here. What can each of you do? What can we all do? It's wonderful here tonight to see such a cross-section of generations. We elders, which I count myself amongst the elders now, we're passing something on to the younger people. This is a wonderful time for us to really look at how we're going to do that and where we're going to take it. So that's basically what we'll be looking at tonight. It's a history and an economics lesson in a way. But before I get into that part of the talk, just a couple of words on the book. And the book is really a history lesson and an economics lesson. And yet, I definitely tried to write it not as an economic theory or thesis, because most people don't read those. There's a lot of great books about this out there, but I'm an economist, and I don't read most of them. I can't make my way through them. And so I tried to write this book from a very personal standpoint, telling my own story. Every word in the book is true, but trying to write it in a way where we can really move people and get a lot of people to really start thinking on these subjects, because we're at a pivotal point in history right now, a very, very important time in the history of the world. And it's important that we get as many people involved as we possibly can. So now, back to the story itself. And the real history of post-World War II world starts with World War I, because my parents came through a very, very difficult time. It started with World War I, and then went into the Great Depression, and then World War II. It was a time of tremendous fear. It was a time when people in this country felt under attack from all kinds of places. And they went into World War II not having any idea that we were going to be successful, that Hitler and Japan were going to be defeated. It was a very stressful time, a time that was filled with great anxiety. At the end of World War II, it was decided to create what's called the Bretton Woods organizations. Again, created in my home state, New Hampshire, as we say it up there. Why is it that people from New Hampshire and Vermont can't put R's on the end of the words, but if it ends in an IA like Laconier, you put an R on the end? I haven't figured that out yet, but it's how I grew up speaking. Anyway, Bretton Woods created the World Bank, the IMF, and the other Bretton Woods organizations in order to reconstruct a devastated Europe and Japan. And these organizations did a very good job at that. However, they immediately became politicized, because following World War II, the enemy became Russia, the Soviet Union, and communism. This became the new enemy immediately as we emerged from World War II. And so part of the mission of the World Bank and the IMF and the other organizations was to prove that capitalism was better than communism, to show that in reconstructing Europe and Japan, we could create an alternative to the Soviet model and the emerging Chinese model that was far superior. And so these great organizations that did reconstruct these devastated parts of the world also became politicized from the beginning. And as we moved into time, some interesting things began to happen. In 1951, a president was elected to the presidency of Iran, democratically elected for the first time, and his name was Mossadegh. And he was held out to the Middle East, and in fact to the whole world, as a great hope for the future of democracy. In fact, he was Time magazine's Man of the Year in 1951, Mossadegh, democratically elected premier of Iran. But one of the first things Mossadegh decided was that the oil companies were making too much money off of his people. About 85% of all the value of all the oil drilled in Iran, 85% of it was being taken abroad, and his people were only getting about 15%. And so he clamped down on the oil companies, particularly what is now BP, British Petroleum. The British tried to enlist the aid of the Americans. Truman wouldn't go along with it. But when Eisenhower became president, he decided that he would help the British out and that we needed to get rid of Mossadegh, this democratically elected president. However, Iran sits on the border with Russia. Russia was the enemy, the new enemy. And Russia had nuclear weapons, as did we. We were scared to death of nuclear weapons. There's a few of you out there, I can see you, you're in my generation. You remember climbing under the desks in third grade or second grade or fourth grade. The sirens would go off and it was the air drills. You know, we were going to be bombed with nuclear weapons from Russia. And the way to save yourself from a nuclear holocaust was to climb under your desk at school. Duck and cover. So whenever I hear a fire alarm these days, I climb under my desk. So we didn't feel that we could overtly send the military into Iran. Too risky, far too dangerous. So instead, they decided to try a uniquely new approach. Send in a CIA agent whose name was Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy's grandson. Kermit went in with a few million dollars In a very short amount of time, he created havoc in Iran. He hired people to organize strikes and protests, rallies in the streets, burn the president or the premier in effigy. And to make a long story short, the longer story is in Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He overthrew this democratically elected premier and replaced him with the Shah. And we all know about the Shah. The Shah was a bloody dictator who I worked for and was anything but representing democracy. This was so successful, however, that the United States decided that this is the way to create empire. This is the way to take over countries. We don't need to use the military. We can use people like Kermit Roosevelt. Kermit really was the first economic hitman. However, the problem was that Kermit was a card-carrying CIA agent, a government employee. Had he been found out, the government would have been embarrassed, to say the least. And so very shortly after that, the decision was made that in the future, we could use the CIA and the National Security Agency, the NSA, to recruit agents, perhaps to train them, but that people like economic hitmen would work for private corporations. And that's still the way it is. As time went by, this model became increasingly successful. And in 1968, I was in school in Boston, and I was recruited by the National Security Agency, nation's largest spy organization, probably its least understood. And they ran me through a series of very intensive tests, including lie detector tests, and in the process discovered a couple of things. One was that I had the potential for being a good economic hitman, and I'll tell you more about what that entails in a little bit. And the other was that I had a lot of weaknesses in my character. Weaknesses they could exploit. And so, again, to make a long story short, I ended up going in the Peace Corps after being recruited by the National Security Agency with their encouragement. And I was sent to Ecuador to live in the Amazon and the Andes with people who were resisting oil companies at the time and still are right now preparing to go to war with our oil companies. So in a way, I got some very very valuable on-the-job training as well as learning another language and learning about other cultures. While I was still in the Peace Corps, a vice president from Charles T. Maine's company in Boston came down and visited me and continued my recruitment, and he had connections with the National Security Agency. I was hired by Charles T. Maine. Probably most of you haven't heard that name. We were a very low-profile company. We had about 2,000 employees. The company was 100 years old when I was hired by them. Our offices were in the Prudential Center in Boston, 8 floors there. And the company now has disappeared, essentially. It's been absorbed into another organization, and its name is no longer being used officially. But I was recruited into Charles T. Maine and immediately began training with an amazing woman named Claudine. Now, Claudine was incredibly intelligent, clever, cunning, very seductive. She knew all my weaknesses. She was privy to the NSA files. They'd done all these tests on me. They knew everything about me. And Claudine seduced me into being an economic hitman. I mean, I take full responsibility. I'm not trying to shirk my responsibility here. But she really, she offered me everything that I dreamed of. And in the book, I talk a lot about my background growing up very poor in New Hampshire. My father was a prep school teacher. We had a good life. The housing and food and everything was provided by the school, but we never had any cash. On the other hand, I grew up with these very, very wealthy kids from other countries and other places. And I had a real strong inferiority complex, and I was very shy, especially around women. And Claudine knew how to bring me in. At the same time, she made it very clear to me that what my job was to do, and my job was to create an American empire. And the way that we economic hitmen work is essentially We go out and identify third world countries that have resources that we covet. Let's say oil, that's one of them. And we arrange for a very large loan to be made from the international financial community, usually led by the World Bank, to this third world country. One of the conditions of that loan is that most of it will never leave the United States. It'll be transferred from a bank in Washington to one in San Francisco, Houston, New York, where the big consulting firms are that lead these projects. You know the firms. You hear about them in the news a lot these days, like Halliburton, Bechtel, Stone & Webster in Boston, Charles D. Maine in my day. And these companies then, so the majority of the money, roughly 90% of it, never leaves the United States. It goes directly to these companies. These companies go back to the third world country and build projects like power plants, industrial parks, ports that serve the very rich in those countries, usually never reach the poor. The country now is saddled with a huge debt, even though the money never actually got there. And because it has this huge debt, it can't make payments for health, education, and other social services for its poor people. It's stuck with an amazing debt that it cannot repay, and that's part of the plan, to put it in such debt that it can't repay it. So at some point in time, we economic hitmen go back to that country and we say, look, you owe us a lot of money, you can't pay your debt, therefore sell our oil companies your oil real cheap, even if that means destroying your rainforest, as is what's happening in Ecuador today, Peru, Colombia, Bolivia, many other places, and your indigenous cultures. We don't care. Sell our oil companies your oil real cheap, or let us use your canal, or vote with us at this critical UN vote that's coming up, or give us land for military bases, or send troops to Iraq or someplace else in support of us. And in this way, we've created an empire. Let there be no doubt about it. In the last 50 years since World War II, we have created the only truly global empire in the history of mankind. It's not only a global empire in the traditional sense of the word, in that we bring most of the world's resources into this country. That's one of the definitions of an empire. We do. We're about 5% of the world's population consuming over 25% of its resources. But it's also an empire like none other, in that our language is the one that's spoken in all diplomatic circles and all commercial circles. Our movies are watched all over the world. Our books are read all over the world. Our music is the predominant music around the world. Our medicine is the predominant medicine. Our science is the predominant science. Our communication systems are the predominant communication systems. We invented the internet. And we also have the strongest military to back us up if we need. But we usually don't use it. Now, this empire, Claudine would make it very clear to me as she was training me in this process, is built on economic hitmen. If, however, the economic hitmen fail, which is seldom the case, but I'll tell you a few examples where I personally was involved where we did fail, then the next line of defense is what we call the jackals. These are CIA-sanctioned assassins. They'll start off by trying to overthrow a government, as they did in Iran, as I've just mentioned. But if they're unsuccessful at overthrowing the government, then they'll assassinate whoever they need to assassinate. Once again, they're sanctioned by the CIA. Usually, almost never are they CIA employees, any more than I was an NSA employee. They work for private companies. If the jackals should fail after the economic hitmen have also failed, then and only then do we send in the military. Our young men and women in uniform are our last line of defense. That's what's happened in Iraq, and I'll go into that more in a few minutes. So Claudine made this very clear to me, and she made it very clear to me what my role as an economic hitman was. And she also made it very clear to me that if I went along with this, I'd realize all the dreams of my life. It wasn't so much about being paid well. I got paid pretty well, but it wasn't that great. But I always traveled first class. Flew, you know, up in the hump of the 747s, and I traveled all over the world. I've been to, you name the country, I've probably been there and spent a lot of time there. stayed in the best hotels, ate in the finest restaurants, and was surrounded by beautiful women. So all the goodies that I'd been deprived of or felt I had were offered to me. At the same time, Claudine also made it very clear to me that I was getting into what she called a dirty business. And that once I was in, as she put it, once you're in for life. And you can never speak about this to anybody, not your wife, not your parents, nobody. You must take an oath of silence, which I took. And she said, if you're not willing to do all these things, then don't go on your first assignment, which was to be in Indonesia in 1971. But I went. And so I entered the ranks of economic hitmen and worked in many places around the world doing many different things. And the most common scenario was the one like I just described. And I ended up having a staff of about 50 people. I should tell you, my title at Charles T. Maine, this Boston firm, was chief economist. I also became it was a partnership, a closely held corporation, and I became the youngest partner in its 100-year history. I ended up having a staff of about 50 people working for me. My title was chief economist. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in economics. I never felt of myself as an economist. And this is an interesting point, because what an economic hitman does has nothing to do really with economics. We cut deals. And that's what I was good at, convincing people to accept the deals, convincing leaders of other countries, bribing them, legally bribing them. And then I had a bunch of really good economists, PhDs, MBAs, people like that, who produced the reports and the econometric studies that I wanted in order to justify the deals. That's how international economics really works. That's the way the World Bank really works. The deals are cut, the economics are produced to justify the deals. That's what we did. I'll give you a couple of examples. I'd like to talk about the places where I failed, because I think those are the most poignant. Panama. Omar Torrijos was president of Panama, head of state of Panama. And he followed a long line. Panama, as probably most of you know, was stolen from Colombia back in the early 1900s so that we could build a canal there. The treaty that was signed for the original canal was never signed by any Latin American. It was signed by two U.S. representatives and a Frenchman, granting the right to this land in Panama. And for many years, we ran Panama because we owned the oligarchy that was officially in charge. And then there was a coup that threw them out, and Omar Torrijos was put in as head of state. He was a magnificent man, very charismatic. I think he would have won the Nobel Prize had he survived, and very popular among his people. Very integritous, very dedicated man, dedicated to the poor of his country. I describe in the book how he called me into his house one day, and we sat there, and he said, look, I know what you're trying to do here. I know the way you guys work. It's not going to work here. I know that if you do what you intend to do, what you've done in all these other countries, I'll become fabulously wealthy, because that's one of the things that happens. We make sure that the leaders who strike the deals with us make out like bandits. But he said, I'm not interested in becoming wealthy. I'm interested in helping my poor people. And so if you want to work in this country, you're going to have to do it my way and help my poor people. Otherwise, you can get out. I came back to Boston to my bosses back here and relayed this to them. And we decided, well, let's work in Panama. Let's work with Torrijos. It's not fulfilling the mission of the economic hitmen, but, you know, we'll do some interesting projects. Oh, he said, if you do these projects for us and you do them well, I'll make sure you get more, and I'll make sure you get really interesting ones. So Panama was a great lesson for me, because we did some really good projects in Panama where we really helped the poor people. And what I saw is that you can use foreign aid to really help poor people. You can do irrigation systems for rural farmers, and you can help small fishermen. You can help them buy boats, and you can help co-ops and women's knitting co-ops or making handicrafts. There's a lot of things you can do. We did them. We did them very successfully. But the problem was, I knew that Torrijos was in trouble because he was setting a precedent. He was standing up to the system. The system around the world is built on the premise that leaders are corruptible. And when one leader says, I'm not corruptible, and gets away with it, that causes problems or potential for problems. And at the same time, almost, that Torrijos was doing this, in a country not far away, Ecuador, the one where I'd been a Peace Corps volunteer, a man named Jaime Roldós became president. Now, Jaime Roldós was democratically elected in a landslide after decades of totalitarian rule by military dictatorships in Ecuador. And Roldós ran on a platform of getting the oil companies to pay their dues to the Ecuadorian people or nationalizing them. And so after he became president, he began to implement this policy. So you had at the same time these two men who worked together to some degree, Torrijos in Panama and Roldós in Ecuador. I was in Ecuador trying to bring Roldós around, trying as an economic hitman to get him to accept our deals, and worried in both cases that if these guys didn't accept our deals, something bad was going to befall them. And it did. 3 months apart in 1981, they were both assassinated, died in fiery airplane accidents. Helicopter for Roldós blew up as it took off, and an airplane for Torrijos, his private plane. There's no question about it. You can speak to any Latin American today who was involved in any of the investigations. It was the CIA-sanctioned jackals. No question about it in my mind and most people's mind there. Of course, the FBI didn't find that to be the case. They reached no conclusion. Another case where we failed. Well, first let me go to a case where we really succeeded very, very well, and that is Saudi Arabia.
We'll hear about Saudi Arabia next week, along with a good deal of other interesting stuff, including the real reason the U.S. military invaded Panama in 1989 and overthrew President Noriega, about the blowback from the oligarchy's so-called success in Saudi Arabia, blowback which included 9/11, Perkins says. We'll hear more about corporate foxes guarding government henhouses, about the fate of all empires, and about what we citizens can do to hasten that fate. Thanks to John Schwenk for the recording, and to you, dear listener, for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. For more information, great links, and a free archive of past shows, check out newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and let's keep trying to live each day as though the truth were true. Ciao!